Good morning.
Greetings, everyone.
This is Wednesday, February 3rd, 2021, and this is episode 165 of Transmission.
Yeah, it's a lovely day here in Minneapolis.
I mean, it's really, the sun is shining, which you can tell because my face isn't as illuminated because there's so much brightness around me. Mm-hmm. It's going to get above freezing.
Yeah.
It's like spring has sprung almost.
Winter doesn't exist anymore, which is actually very disturbing, but does tend to make people happy in some ways. So I'm Daniel Wolpert. I direct MICA, the Minnesota Institute of Contemplation and Healing.
I'm Mark Van Stunek. I direct the Center for Prophetic Imagination. And today this is a complicated, and maybe we should put our bona fides out. I am not a mental health professional whatsoever. I mean, I've studied it because when you're a pastor and spiritual direction, you'd have to dabble, but only enough to be dangerous. But I struggle with all kinds of mental illness. So, and it's affected my family. So my experience of this conversation topic is kind of like from within some stigma shit with some opinions. But I'm not a mental health professional.
Yeah. And your exemplary wisdom that we highlighted the other day.
Indeed. It goes without saying, Dan. Why even bring it up?
Yeah. And so, and, you know, I'm somebody that both has and has had mental health issues my whole life. And I'm also a mental health professional. I have been for over 35 years. So this conversation came out of actually a lot of the conversation yesterday, but also other conversations that we've had, and you know, this entire question of how we use terms related to our mental state is very important. It's important in terms of how we're dealing with individual people. It's important in terms of how we're dealing with some of the systemic issues that we're facing. It's important in terms of a lot of the conversation about our leaders. Mm-hmm. So it's a big thing. And we thought we'd devote an entire issue to it. And but first, we got to talk with our climate change deniers. I'm just kidding. I know you're not.
Tyler says, Dan, you won't be saying winter doesn't exist a few days when it's 30 below zero.
Yeah, I still will be saying that, Tyler, because, you know, it'll be 30 below zero for a day. And, you know, it's funny how quickly we forget, right? I mean, I remember one winter when we lived in New England where the warmest it got for the entire month of January was 10 below zero. That was the high for the entire month. And, you know, months like that just don't exist. Yeah, well, you know, we'll get a couple days, you know, and people go, oh my God, this is so horrible. It's below zero for 2 days. And it's like, that's not winter.
Yeah, I remember like
a little blast.
I feel like getting 20, 30 below was not like super every day in the winter growing up in kind of central to northern Minnesota, but it was not uncommon.
And there
I remember several times growing up where it got below like to 40 below.
Oh, yeah.
And now I'm not even talking about wind chill factor. But now, like, if it gets even to like 10 below, it's kind of astonishing.
Yeah.
It's more unique. So, yes, and to anyone else who hadn't experienced 40 below as a regularity, that might still seem like winter. And indeed it is. It's still freaking cold, but it's not. Winter ain't what it used to be.
No, not anywhere close. And you especially experienced that when you were walking to school 9 miles uphill both ways, right?
That's right.
That's right. Those good old one-room schoolhouses.
I remember it was like 15 below, and I fell asleep behind the wheel and woke up with snow flying over the car, and I was like 3 miles into town, three or four, and I just had a little jacket and loafers and dress socks on, and I'm like, fuck it, I'm going to walk. I'm a Minnesotan. By the time I got to town to my brother's apartment, my feet were purple.
Yeah.
So it's like these sort of heroic tales won't exist in the future when it's warm and you'll have to try hard to get frostbite.
That's right.
You have to try.
You have to work at it.
It won't happen.
Okay. All right. Back to our topic. So as we often tend to do, I think it would be great to start off with a little bit of history to locate ourselves in all of this. So, you know, everybody throughout time has recognized that human beings have different states of mind. And some of these states of mind are common, and some states of mind are more uncommon. And some states of mind seem very extreme. Some states of mind cause a lot more suffering than others. And so some states seem more beneficial than others. Mm-hmm. And so every society has had a way of talking about that. And, you know, as we've talked about with capitalism, like capitalism is not some objective reality that is, you know, imposed upon human beings as this best economic system ever. And in the same way, our current model of mental well-being is also not the only model that exists. So, you know, for example, in many societies, right, the idea of non-material forces, which sometimes get called demons, taking people over, is one model of mental well-being and not. In the Buddhist tradition, you know, there's a 2,500-year, very sophisticated tradition of describing mental states and how to work with those. And in that, there's really very much this continuum of mental processes. So there isn't a sense that, you know, one type of mental state is well and another type is ill. There really is much more of a sense of, you know, an ego self with habitual patterns and an enlightened mind, and both of those kind of coexisting within all of reality. Mm-hmm. The other thing is that different traditions will also have ways of talking about individual mental states versus collective mental states. Right? So there are many traditions that recognize that our mental state is not just ours sort of sitting within the brain, you know, and there's this solid wall between us and everybody else. Mm-hmm. But that mind is a much more dispersed property, mm-hmm. and that we share in that. And so my mental state is composed of my own experience and what comes from me, but it's also composed of other people's experiences. So all of these different systems have existed throughout history. And when we got into the 20th century in America, right around the same time as the fundamental movement, which we've talked about before, there was a similar movement within medicine, because there were many different types of medicine being practiced in the West and in America. So there was what we call allopathic medicine, there was homeopathic medicine, there was naturopathic medicine, there was osteopathic medicine, right? Many different systems. And each one of these had a slightly different view of mental well-being and not well-being. And there was a big political power play as there so often is in human systems. And a group of allopathic doctors got together and commissioned something called the Flexner Report. And you can Google that and read up on it if you want. Basically, they decided that allopathic medicine was the only sort of truly valid medicine in America. And that was really the beginning of the major takeover by our entire medical system of this, what we now call this medical model of health and illness. And so so that is the model that that we have inherited. Now, for a while, when, you know, basically psychoanalysis was the primary Western psychological model, that kind of existed alongside of the medical model of physical illness. But increasingly, particularly because of the lobbying of the drug companies, increasingly, mental well-being and not well-being has been subsumed into this medical model of health and wellness.
And there's, I mean, we could probably have an entire podcast dedicated to talking about all the specifics of this, and I'm sure they exist. There's probably a podcast out there that focuses just on mental health and this, but there's all kinds of downsides to that. And to me, just again, to make a disclaimer, Dan and I were talking about this before, and I take several medications. And my son does too. He's 12. I get judgment all the time for the fact that my son takes a medication, and because there's all this stigma around it. And there's also this recognition that shouldn't be that way. In a good world, we wouldn't have to take medications. And my thought is, you're right. I actually don't think that I'm somehow, I don't think it's good enough to say that my mom was mentally ill, therefore I inherited it. And so it's just a purely material deficiency that needs to be corrected with material means. That's hugely problematic in so many levels. It puts all the blame on the atomized individual as the inheritor of something. It doesn't look at systems. It doesn't look at our whole embodiment. And it plus the other thing within mental health, there's often the talk about how, you know, when it's just diagnostic, you're only looking for problems. So the question... A psychiatrist isn't today the place you'd go to ask, how can I become a more full and thriving human being? A psychiatrist is where you go to say, how can you fix me? I'm fucked up. And that's a problematic way of starting to thinking about what wellness is that normal people are healthy. And then there's these fuck ups that need help. There's very little analysis that goes into that or understanding what makes people unwell in the various ways of being human.
Yeah, and you know, we actually even see similar problems in physical illness in terms of this medical model. So the medical model of illness really comes out of what is sometimes called the germ theory of illness, right? And so when people discovered germs, right, discovered bacteria and all this stuff, they were like, oh wow, this is great. Okay, now we have a very specific reason that people get sick. They get, you know, too many bacteria growing in the wrong place. And so, you know, we then find something to kill the bacteria and we get well. Similarly with, my mind just went blank. Similarly with stuff like broken arms and legs, I was trying to think of the sophisticated term, but my mind went blank. You know, it's obvious that, okay, if you got a bone sticking out of your leg, that's the problem. And you put your leg in a cast and, you know, you heal and you get better. But the thing is that there are many, many illnesses that are clearly not simply the result of some simple cause and effect issue like that. And so, you know, we are seeing more and more that this very strict medical model just does not account for all kinds of things that are going on. Things that are going on inside of us, things that are going outside of us. So for example, if I live in a food desert and I can only buy garbage food to feed my family and my family gets an illness, well, what is really the cause of that illness, right? Is it something physically going on inside of me? Well, in some ways, right? I'm overeating sugars and all kinds of garbage. But really, the cause of that illness is social, mm-hmm. right? It's the fact that I cannot have access to or I cannot afford healthy food,
yeah.
right? And society is feeding me garbage, right? And so then I may take medication for my diabetes because I now have this thing that, you know, the symptoms are bad and problematic. But the medication is not really fixing the illness. Right? The medication is providing symptom relief, and it's very important. But really, to fix the illness, you would redo food distribution in the United States. That would fix the illness.
Yeah, and just so much is driven. Like, so this is where we have this medical model and capitalism kind of becoming friends with the way billing works. In hospitals, it's like we got to figure out what the specific thing is, do it as cheaply as quickly as possible, and we can only look at this atomized individual. Within therapy, you can maybe do family systems kind of therapy, but generally speaking, mental health is treated the same way. Mm-hmm. And there's no real deeper asking of like, well, what's the best way for this person to be healthy?
Right. So, and one very specific example of this, so the DSM, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, which is the big diagnostic Bible of mental health, mm-hmm. and which then also you have to code using that to get your services paid for. Mm-hmm. Insurance companies do not recognize nor until very recently were there even sophisticated diagnosis codes for family problems. So, for example, as a family therapist, if I was treating a family, but I wanted their insurance to pay, even though it was very clear to me that I was treating the entire family, I would have to make up diagnoses for the individuals in order for that to get paid for. So this entire medical system is now forcing us in this one direction, in this one set of descriptions, and is not really giving us any kind of, really sophisticated, deep, broad description of the mental reality that we're all facing. Mm-hmm. I got some comments coming in.
Tyler writes, there's that quote, it's no measure of health to be well adjusted to a profoundly sick society. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's a lot to this. And, mm-hmm. you know, we were talking beforehand about how we different ways we could get in trouble in this episode because there's a lot of hot topic stuff. But to me, this is helpful to think about mental health this way, but also when you're reading scriptures and reading about demons, like our assumption usually is demons happen to bad people. And so it's because of their sin. But to me, the way to understanding demons possessing someone is that an individual who is sensitive is inflicted by the problems of the society to the point where they manifest it like a mirror to give the society a chance to repent. So in some ways, you could say they're a sacrament, a means of divine grace. Right. And so to me, this is kind of what, you know, the designated patient is, or if someone's unwell mentally in a capitalist society, it's an indictment of the system. And the system has a desire to scapegoat that person and cast them out. But to me, it's an opportunity to say, look at all these people. Look at all these children struggling with mental health right now. Right. So it's an indictment of the system.
Yeah. And you see, this is why, to me, the contemplative psych lens is so much more valuable than the medical model, because that lens, first of all, does not really talk about these discrete individual illnesses. It basically looks at states of mind and a continuum of states of mind. And it looks at the entire person within their social ecology. And it basically says, what are the factors that are engaging this person? How are they engaging their experience? What are the things that have happened to them? And then it really says, okay, well, you know, what's the best way to be of help? And is open to all kinds of different modalities, not based on some idealized type, right? I mean, we were talking before about, you know, how there'll be these memes like, oh, depressed, don't take medication, just go for a jog, right? And, you know, that's really horrible, right? I mean, obviously, if going for one jog would, you know, make somebody not depressed, everybody would, you know, be doing that. Now, can jogging help? Yes, sure. It can. But when you don't have a holistic view and you're not willing to be open to all kinds of different helps, you end up atomizing everything in the same way that the medical model does, and it's not helpful to people.
Gus says, whenever these topics come up, I think of a client I worked with years ago who had a developmental disability that reduced his cognitive ability severely. And yet, he was, despite extreme hardship throughout his life, one of the most joyous people that I'd ever met. Mm-hmm. Well, and so this is interesting. Like, again, because of that, our system, we focus on the disability part, not the joy part. Mm-hmm. How do we fix the disability part? Not how do we affirm and lift up the joy part, because we don't know.
And this is the same way. And you know, as you're saying, the medical model and capitalism are very integrated. And I don't know if Julia's Dinsmore is listening today, but she talks about this all the time in terms of folks experiencing poverty, right? Is that the system is always looking at people from the perspective of weaknesses and problems, and not looking at them from the perspective of the strengths of their culture and their individual abilities. And this is the problem with the illness related model. It's one thing to say, oh, my arm is broken, yeah, I need to be in a cast. But when you're talking about the whole person, right? So our mental experience, our states of mind involve our whole person. And to start to somehow say that, you know, a person is sick is really, really problematic on many, many levels, right? And it's much more valuable to begin to engage the sum total of our experience, which sometimes involves suffering and sometimes involves joy and not suffering. And sometimes the suffering is actually helpful, right? So the medical model flattens all of this into a very actually pathological perspective on people.
Yeah. So Julia says, we are so pathologized. And, you know, this brings up another thing, like talking about suffering. Okay, so in our society that's pluralistic, we don't have the same categories that we share about things like sin or different ways of talking about malformation. But we do share this medical model as kind of the default. And so wellness becomes the dominant metaphor for talking about everything in life. And medical model is the way we kind of deal with everything. So then the common good is people living longer and dying less. That's the ultimate goal, the ultimate good. And because of that, suffering is avoided. Now, I don't want to valorize suffering and say that all suffering is somehow redemptive. No. But, and this is an important but, when you pathologize the avoidance of suffering, you end up with all kinds of horrible shit. Right. I mean, this is, you know, Dorothy Sola talks about, you know, this, the middle class consciousness tendency towards apathy being a manifestation of the pathologized avoidance of suffering. Meaning that if you think the ultimate good is avoidance of suffering, you're going to miss out on all kinds of stuff. You're going to miss out on all the pathos and the passions and the pains that actually are part of the transcendent and abundant life. Mm-hmm. And so again, this is where this model does for us, is that we don't know what it means to be fully human. We only know how to avoid feeling like shit. That's
not well.
And the irony is, we're not even good at it.
Right. The irony is, the more we try to avoid that, the less it works. I mean that's one of the interesting twists of all of this.
Because it's an insufficient way of understanding the world, and so it's flawed. Ceres writes this: the medical model is not necessarily scientific.
Yes.
Which I'm sure maybe there's people listening who are like, "What?" Yet we still push this false equivalencies. Many neuroscience research is challenging the medical model of mental health, yet we still enable unscientific and inhumane bullshit on mental and physical illness.
Yeah. And just to give one specific example, if this is something new to you, this comment. So one of the images or myths that has been again pushed by this medicalizing model is this idea of, you know, mental wellness, mental illness being quote genetic, right? And you just gave an example of that, Mark, like my mom's depressed, I'm depressed, therefore I inherited it. This is actually not how genetics works, but it's the sense that we have about how genetics works. And so, we're kind of given all of these little shorthands that sound scientific-y, and many of them are just completely wrong. Another great example of how the drug companies have pushed this is that in Japan, there was no term for mild depression. There was no word for that or series of words for that. And about two decades ago, the drug companies invented a word, which they started, circulating in society through their marketing. And then, of course, right behind that was, and we have a medicine to fix this. There's all kinds of ways that science gets misused. And so this is some of my concern when everybody goes, well, we have to listen to science, blah, 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 in some kind of uncritical sort of way, because, yeah, science is good and helpful. And the scientific system is just as subject to corruption as any other system. So we have to be careful with that.
Well, I mean, it goes into so many different directions. Like when we start at a certain point, and I might step into it with this one, but like the autism spectrum is getting so large that you start thinking maybe it shouldn't be called one spectrum. And so, and the reason it exists like that is because we have to figure out a way to diagnose so that we can remedy it. And there's of course this huge battle between people who want like their kids cured of autism and other people saying, look, autism is actually a one way of being human. That's fine. You just got to stop being so fucking judgmental about it and let this kid be fine in a system that works for him instead of trying to force him to adapt to an unhealthy system. So it gets into all this sort of complexity we can't even talk about properly if all we have is a diagnostic medical model to talk about everything.
Yeah. And Becca's comment gets at this.
We ignore the spiritual needs that depression, anxiety, trauma, and other mental health issues are drawing our attention to when we medicalize and treat without being curious about why or how our culture works to make us mentally ill.
Mm-hmm.
Susan or Ellen writes, I resisted people calling the last president crazy because we let people off the hook if they weren't in control of their mind.
Yeah, actually, before we get into that, James had a good comment.
James writes, the person who is struggling with mental health is often the healthiest person in the system.
Right. Yeah. And so, you know, this is where you're lifting up, James, is something out of systemic analysis where, again, the experiences and behaviors and states of mind of the individuals in the system are reflective of systemic functioning, right? And so, for example, the teenager who is acting out, who is angry, who is, you know, breaking things, who is not doing well in school, and who is then the one that gets labeled with a mental illness, right? Conduct disorder is one of the most common diagnoses in the mental health world, particularly among teenagers. But from a systemic point of view, that person is the person who actually is understanding and embodying the dysfunction of the system the best. So in some ways, they are the most aware and, in that sense, healthiest person in a system that's in total denial. Mm-hmm. But yeah, that's not the way that the DSM codes that that experience.
Well, in Ellen's comment, like, it shows the complexity. Like, is Donald, to me, the issue isn't that Donald Trump was merely, if we say, narcissistic personality disorder. That's not all that's involved. Like, if you just had any old person with a narcissism as a president, it doesn't mean we'll always end up with this. There's all kinds of formation. There's all sorts of systems, beliefs that are kind of out of whack in different kinds of ways. And so we can diagnose someone with this, but that doesn't really solve the issue or get at the nature of the problem exactly. Mm-hmm. To me, you know, this is what we point at. Like, when we think about systems, Donald Trump was tapping into an existing sensibility that was kind of lurking more in the shadows, although white supremacy is hardly in the shadows at all, mm-hmm. and allowed people to come out in force. And so there's just a lot going on. And so if we only talk about it from the framework of the mental health model, using the term crazy to talk about that, where we fail to really diagnose what the issue is. And even worse, we fail to understand how we can move past it and be healthy. Because right now we just cut out the cancer that is Donald Trump, if we want to use that metaphor, and like, look, stuff's still going wrong.
Yeah.
He could die tomorrow and we'd still have these problems. So it's not that he was a cancer.
Yeah. Yeah. And I kind of go back and forth on this, this whole issue with this term crazy. I mean, you know, part of me is sympathetic to the fact that every language has idioms. Sometimes the idioms are helpful. Sometimes they become unhelpful. So I appreciate how all kinds of terms related to mental illness have been negative and used against people. At the same time, I also understand that, you know, a lot of folks are not going to be able to understand or figure out other kinds of jargon. And so they're going to use buzzwords, which, by the way, you know, happens even within the mental health field, right? I mean, Mark, you mentioned autism. But there have been many diagnoses over the last 30, 40 years that have kind of become these pet diagnoses. And then everybody just uses the diagnostic term to describe almost anybody. So the language around this is challenging. And I guess I feel like what's most helpful is to really have more sophisticated, in-depth conversations, so we're more on the same page about what are our underlying models, what is our understanding of what it is to be human, what is the nature of our mental state, how does that interact both individually and systemically.
We're coming to the end of our time, so we're going to blaze through these last comments. Viv writes, a lot of leading mental health experts want to educate the public about dangerous leaders on the national platform. This is one of the reasons they formed in the past 4 years, the World Mental Health Coalition. Plus, America democracy will not last unless we address the root issue of the past 4 to 5 years alone. Severe plus dangerous psychopathologies of 45 and how his mental pathology is spread throughout the entire nation. My comment is in relation to dangerous.
And Viv is really up on a lot of this stuff. And she was on Transmission once. She's always posting a lot of great articles, podcasts, videos. So please take a look at the information that she's putting out there and sharing. It's really good, really good stuff.
You know, things like that always make me wonder. There's always a chicken and egg situation with like Trump and Trump supporters, which caused which, that I think is complicated. And so I think it's true that Donald Trump's pathology is kind of like leached out into society and kind of erupted into a similar pattern with people. But at the same time, some of that pre-existed and made it so that Donald Trump could come into power to begin with, which is terrifying. Tyler writes, key part to any DSM diagnosis requires negatively impacting one's life, which of course necessitates the idea of a healthy system, which is part of the problem because we don't know how to talk about what a healthy system is in our society.
Right.
Tyler writes, at the same time, learning about my own issues with anxiety, ADHD, and especially trauma have been quite liberating for myself, helped me to do things I want to do.
Right. And so that's the thing is that as we engage with our states of mind and our experiences, in relation to others and to the whole system that we're in, I mean, that's what becomes very healthy and uplifting. Right. And, you know, and again, this is what the contemplative traditions have always talked about, that the, you know, cure for every state of mind, right, positive states of mind as well as negative states of mind, is really to begin to pay attention to that experience and to reflect on that very deeply. And that's very liberatory. Mm-hmm.
James writes, I would always get into this argument with folks. A mentally ill person who is self-aware would be a great president. The problem with Trump was that he was evil. It's hard for me to label a human being as evil, yeah. But I recognize kind of the thrust of that. And you're right. Like, maybe I would make a great president, but I'm sure I'd do a better job, in part because my struggles with mental health make me sympathetic and sensitive and stuff and make me introspective, you know. I don't know. Yeah, Lincoln wasn't a great president all around. Like, there's also criticism, but I mean, he's one of the people presidents folks point to when they talk about presidents with depression.
Well, you know, and what that brings up, Mark, as you're describing that, and again, this is something that the medical model just has a very hard time talking about, is the fact that our mind operates on these two planes, right? The habitual pattern plane and the plane of awareness. Mm-hmm. And you can have very, very challenging habitual patterns going on that may be hard and may, again, cause suffering. And if you have a lot of awareness going on that other plane, you work with that and experience that state very differently than if you have very low awareness, right? And so one of the things, for example, that is talked about with this diagnosis of narcissistic personality disorder is that people with that tend to have very, very low self-awareness. Right. And so, you know, so again, within the different systems, right? And this is the problem, again, with these words, because we're always crossing different models, right? So when we use the word evil, I mean, that's not coming out of a medical model. Medical model has nothing to say about that, right? That's coming out of this spiritual, moral realm and model. So you'd really have to flesh that all out. You know, well, what do you mean by that word? And but within the medical model, what you would say is that somebody with incredibly low awareness and in very, very high narcissism causes a lot of problems for individuals and systems. Now, again, the moral world may call that evil, but that's not something that's not a term that the medical model would use.
Mm-hmm. Catherine writes, I do find it jarring when y'all casually use the C word for what it's worth. Appreciate the conversation and think using alternatives to that word tend to enrich the conversation. I mean, I think that's a good challenge. Like, and you know, I know you talked about the idioms, but like bizarre is a great word that usually gets at what crazy gets at. And part of the problem is it can. I mean, this is the thing. It gets really messy and really complicated. Yeah. Because I don't like it when people say, oh, that person's just nuts, and they use it as a dismissive thing, and that their nutsness is why they get dismissed, then I'm like, well, I'm nuts. So right. I can assume the best intention, but I know there's enough stigma floating around to where you know, I've had my moral failings. Like people point out that I have moral failings or that I have bad politics that because I'm depressed or anxious. So people link these all the time because sloppy categories.
Well, sloppy categories. And, you know, and that gets to a whole other thing that at 40 minutes we haven't even got to, which is the issue of judging mind. Mm-hmm. Right. And so that, right. I mean, when you are using a discussion of mental states as a way of heaping negative moral judgment upon people, that not only is extremely problematic and destructive, but it's also not even within the framework of the medical model. Right. So the medical model is not a judgmental model, but the medical model can be used in the service of negative, horrible judgment. And that's not helpful. And it happens all the time.
It happens when you have Christian supremacy giving birth to colonialism, giving birth to capitalism, medical model emerging within it, and still having some Christian remnants. Then all of a sudden, meritocracy, mental health, and Christian judgment all come together to create a perfect storm of making someone feel like crap about themselves.
And so with that uplifting comment, we will be done. But thank you, everybody. Great conversation. Again, Viv is posting some more links. Check her stuff out. It's really good. Mm-hmm. And we will be back tomorrow.
See you tomorrow.
All right. Love you guys. Bye.